Hi, I'm Kylie King, and I've spent a large chunk of my career as a motorsport television reporter for Network 10 in the early years through to most recently with Supercars Media. And it's my great privilege to welcome you to a very special Talk to Motive podcast as we join Paul Marinelli in celebrating the 30th anniversary of his Australian-based PR and media services company, Marinelli Motorsport. Now, as a motorsport media colleague, I have known Paul from when he first started out as a radio reporter covering Australian and international motor racing events, through to him becoming really one of the country's leading motorsport and automotive PR consultants. And he's still going strong. Congratulations, Paul. What a special milestone.
Thanks, Kylie. Lovely introduction. I appreciate that. Very flattered. Thank you.
And with that great voice of yours, I'm sure it's no surprise to those listening that you started out as a radio announcer and a sports reporter back in the day. But what made you take what I would call quite a brave decision to go out on your own and set up a motorsport-based comms and marketing services business back in 1995?
I wanted to work in motorsport, Kylie, and there just weren't any jobs. You know, you couldn't find a job in motorsport back then unless you wanted to be a mechanic. And so there wasn't a lot of emphasis on PR and media communications and stuff. And I'd traveled a great deal overseas to Formula One, IndyCar and World Rally and other events. And I'd noticed what the PRs were doing there and the strategies they were using. And I thought, no one's doing that in Australia, you know. And so I wanted to bring that expertise or those sort of strategies here. And again, there were no real jobs to get, so I had to create it for myself, and that's what I did. I took a leap of faith. I walked away from a radio career, which I enjoyed very, very much, but instead of just playing music on the radio, I wanted to always talk about motorsport. So I had to find a way to marry that passion into a business, and that's how I went about doing it.
Well, you certainly hit the ground running. What? How many years do you think it took you to get Marinelli PR to be considered really quite the leader in your field? Was it 3, 4, 5 years and the diversity of your clients? Can you talk us through those early years and just how it really took off?
Well, it was really, really interesting the way it went because the timing was just incredible. And again, I didn't plan it this way, but I set it up in 95. You had the Australian Grand Prix come to Melbourne, where I'm based, in 96, which brought a heap of corporate and media interest to Formula One, which really didn't exist that much here beforehand. And then Supercars was established in 1997, V8 Supercars. And we all know how successful that became. So it was sort of the timing ended up being perfect for all of these innovations that were coming into the sport and all of the corporate interest that that generated. So I had sponsors of teams asking me, oh, can you help us promote our products? Can you help us promote this? Can you help us do this? Help us leverage our sponsorships or organize their sponsorships and all that sort of thing. So in terms of time frame, by my second year, I was already working with Glenn Seaton, which was amazing. That was 1996. And I'd pitched to work with the Four Credit Racing team and Glenn, thinking I didn't stand a chance. And they took me on. They took a leap of faith. And I thank Glenn for that because we've been close friends ever since, right through to this day. And ended up working together again at FPR some 20 years later, but that's another story. That was amazing. That was a huge leap forward. And contrary to what a lot of my colleagues thought, that I'd sort of failed miserably, it went extremely well. He had a great season. There was media coming out of everywhere. And it was very, very good. And it sort of set me off. And then from there, it was Formula Holden, a series that really didn't get a lot of recognition in Australia. I worked on that for a good 3 years, and we took it from a minimal exposed category to one of the most major exposed categories in the country. I dare say we'd be second to Supercars at the time, and Tony Cochran used to always remind me of to stop doing such a good job because and to stop saying that they were the fastest racing cars in Australia, which they were, which he didn't like very much. I had a great time, and I worked with a lot of drivers that became future superstars here and overseas, and champions in all sorts of categories, and they were the things in the early years that really, really built up my business. Now, as that was happening in motorsport, the corporate PR side, so working with a lot of the sponsors and companies and suppliers and component manufacturers, that took off as well, and it ended up being a balance of, you know, from about 80% racing to 20% corporate PR, it ended up swinging to like 75% corporate PR and the rest in motorsport. So I kept doing both, but the corporate PR side of the business really, really took off in the late 90s and from there on.
And could you envisage that? You know, what was the plan? So originally, you just love motorsport, you wanted to get in the industry and work in it, but then to see this corporate side of it really explode, did you have that in your mindset of the plan, or was just your ability to be agile and go with the flow and where the demand was?
Well, I'd been brought up in the car business through my dad's automotive repair workshop, where my office is still based to this day, actually. And my brother and I, we grew up under hoists and bonnets of cars. So my knowledge in the aftermarket and the parts and all that sort of thing and how a workshop is run was very, very strong. And that helped me a lot because when component manufacturers tell me about the challenges they had trying to get their products sold to mechanics and et cetera and getting spare parts shops to pick up their things, I understood straight away. They didn't have to explain things to me. And this is where the larger PR companies sort of fell over because they had no knowledge of the industry. And that's what helped a lot. Did I envisage that happening? No. I thought I'd just be doing motorsport stuff, which is all I wanted to do. But that obviously the funding required for motorsport brings all these companies in, some of the world's biggest, by the way. And I ended up finding myself very successful at helping them promote their products, and probably because of the intimate understanding of the industry that I had from my upbringing and my dad's business. So, yeah, I didn't envisage it, but it happened, and I'm glad it happened because it was a good balance. I think if I put all of my eggs into the motorsport basket, business may not have been as successful as what it did become.
Now, speaking of the motorsport industry, and you know, we've touched briefly on the racing categories, but the teams and the drivers over the past 30 years, and the fact, you know, you're still managing one of the country's fastest supercar enduro co-drivers. He just doesn't age, does he? And top three Porsche Carrera Cup racer David Russell. So, wow. I know myself, providing so many stories and story ideas with your drivers and your categories, you are always on the ball. But from your perspective, what would you say have been some of the highlights of the racing side of the business?
Oh, there have been so many over the past 30 years. I've been very, very fortunate. And, you know, sometimes I've had to pinch myself about the opportunities that I've been given and the work I've been able to do. And really, I've got to say, the motorsport side of the business took me all over the world. All over the world, and still continues to do so. You know, it's been extraordinary. I'd say that the ultimate highlight was working alongside David Richards, who owns ProDrive and still does to this day. And when ProDrive bought FPR, I was selected to be the PR consultant for the Ford Performance Racing team. And I got to meet David and all his cohorts and so forth. And one of them, Nick Frye, went on to set up the Braun F1 team and win the world championship and then sell it to Mercedes, which is another story of how I had a really close link with him as well and still do. But with David, he was just amazing. And at the time, they were running the BAR Formula One team, the Subaru World Rally team. They were running the Ferrari GT team, and they were running FPR. So there were all these exciting other things going on. So spending time with him was truly amazing. And he taught me the ability to work all night and all day. Because like him, I'd go to bed at 9 o'clock and get up at 2:30 a.m. That was the start of his day, so that became the start of my day as well. And 2:30 a.m. right through to 9 p.m. that night—that's the hours you work, because that way you could talk to him when he was overseas or his colleagues and deal with stuff. And when he wanted an answer at 3 o'clock in the morning our time, he had to get it right. And I ended up working like that too, and it was great. You can get so much done between 2:30 a.m. and 9 a.m. Let me tell you. But he was amazing, and he still is to this day. We're still close friends, and every time I see him, he's helped me get tests for race drivers overseas, and he's an extraordinary operator. And I really treasured the time that I spent working with him as his publicist and right-hand man whenever he was in Australia. The other real standout would be Bob Jayne, without any doubt, one of Australia's most successful racing drivers and businessmen, the father of franchising in Australia too. I mean, he was doing it long before anyone else even thought about it in this country, and the T-Marts empire. But his passion for motorsport right through until his health declined in his 80s, his passion for motorsport was just extraordinary. And he was a PR machine. He understood PR so well. So when I'd come up to him with a concept order, he'd like say, oh, why don't we do this as well? And why don't we do that as well? And he loved it. And he would do whatever he needed to do to promote his businesses or his beloved Calder Park Raceway. I loved the years I spent with him. That was working on the team outside of the business, but also as media manager at Calder Park for him many, many times. Dave Russell, I mean, we've been together now almost 15 15 years. And he's a wonderful driver. He gets faster as he gets older, I keep telling him. So I'm more than happy to continue. And I managed a few drivers through the years. You would remember when I managed Mark Winterbottom too, from a promising young driver to becoming one of the biggest stars in the sport. That was very exciting. And I got to work with a heap of international drivers as well. You know, David Brabham, Alain Menu, Matt Halliday, Emerson Newton-John, locally Craig Lowndes, Jason Bright, Gary Jacobson, Lee Holdsworth. There's many drivers I worked with from either a management or publicist sort of side of things. And in the end, I just decided the driver management, while with David has been fine and I've continued that and really enjoy it, I decided that that wasn't an area of the business I wanted to continue and pursue moving forward, because I was just busy enough with the PR side of everything. And but I've stayed with David because we're virtually family now, and it's been wonderful working with him, and he always delivers. He's just a great guy.
Oh, I echo that. He is, and he always smiles, you know. And as a reporter, you know, I'd be in pit lane and you'd be interviewing, you know, drivers, and often after an incident. But I tell you what, David Russell, absolute pro, and a pleasure to interview every time I come across him.
With every athlete you work with, and they truly are athletes, you either get the ones who really, really committed to their careers and to helping their careers, and you get the other ones who think the world deserves them a favour. And I refuse to work with the ones that think the world owes them something. You know, I refuse to do that. And David is definitely not like that. And I'm so glad, because there's so many that are. And that was part of the reason why I said, no, I'm not doing that side of the business anymore.
Now, you did touch on that early work you did with Mark Winterbottom, because really he was a virtual unknown. And then your time with him, he really became major motorsports star status. And I have such fond memories of watching Cars 2 with the kids, that Disney Pixar classic that we all know, which features a cameo, obviously, of one of your clients that we've touched on, Mark Winterbottom, at the time, Frosty. Now, in terms of generating PR for a client, getting them on Cars 2 has got to be right up there. And I'm sure it was a team effort, but no doubt you saw an opportunity, and I'm sure you would have gone the extra mile. But to pull that off, that was amazing.
You know, I'm still amazed at how that all happened. It came from a suggestion, and that suggestion came from Supercars, that Mark be involved in promoting the movie with Supercars, because Disney had approached Supercars to be a part of it. And it made sense, you know, and they were doing displays at the circuits, you know, for the kids and all that sort of thing. And Mark was known, you know, we'd marketed him into a position where we'd done hundreds of school visits, literally hundreds of them. So, you know, the kids just loved him and loved the whole Frosty angle. And when I was talking to Supercars about this, about Mark being involved in just some promotions for the movie, I said, well, why can't we get him in the movie? And they're like, oh, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about, Paul? You know, you're crazy and all this stuff. I went to a meeting with the Disney's head office in Melbourne with a person from Supercars, and they're talking about all these promotions and this and that. And I just sort of broke protocol and just said, well, you use Lewis Hamilton for the English version. You use a Japanese driver for the Japanese version. You use a Spanish driver for the Spanish version. Why can't you use an Australian driver for the Australian and New Zealand version of the movie? Because they do make different versions with local race drivers and stuff like that. And they use Americans, obviously, in America. And they sort of all looked at each other and this and that. And they kind of thought, oh, probably not famous enough, this and that. So I came armed with a heap of stats and threw it all at them and put them up on the screen and just gave them an idea of just how valuable and important this would be for encouraging families and kids to see this movie and to buy the DVD and so forth. So there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing after that, but then they agreed to do it. So Frosty, the character, would be a cameo in Cars 2 for Australia and New Zealand. And so I'm ringing up Mark and I'm like, we're going to Burbank. We're going to Burbank, called the voiceover for Frosty, the character in Cars 2. And we're all excited and this and that, and ended up going to a silly little studio in South Melbourne here with a phone on speaker, with the director telling Mark what to say and a screen with some pictures on the thing. So we didn't get that big international trip that we wanted, but he did get into the movie and it was incredible. If we thought he was popular before, after he did that, it just hit the roof. It was just crazy. And I'll never forget all the other team PRs coming up to me and going, Marinelli's done it again, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But I can't take full responsibility on that. It didn't originate from Supercars, but I suppose I pushed it into the next gear to make it happen.
What a great story. And I love that. And I can just visualise you and Frosty having your bags almost ready to pack to head over. But alas, it was back to your old days in a radio studio.
That's right.
Can we talk about how your client base has really grown? Because the commentary stuff, that's an international Formula One and other motorsport events. You're emceeing at all these conferences. I see this amazing work that you're doing that a lot of us in Australia wouldn't be familiar with, because you're doing such amazing things on the global stage.
Yeah, well, I always looked at my business as being a global, not just Australia-based or Australia and New Zealand. I always had that focus, and it probably came from the years of doing reporting from Formula One and IndyCar and rally events all over the world. And that gave me, to look more broadly. Don't limit yourself to what's here. And it was quite interesting how the commentary thing came along, because I'd always loved being a broadcaster. Radio's always been my first love. It still is to this very day. So doing this stuff with you, I just enjoy it so much because it reminds me a lot of the radio days. And I was approached in 2008 by Supercars to become the circuit commentator for the series. Now, I had not approached them on this. They came to me and I said, well, why have you come to me? You know, and they said, well, you've got experience working with both Holden and Ford teams. You've got very recent experience. You've got a great voice, blah, blah, blah. We'd like you to do it. And I thought, oh, okay then. So without any sort of experience of proper track commentary, there I was flung into it at 2008. And I had a great year. I really loved it and worked with Murray Walker at the Adelaide 500. I mean, what a dream come true. It was incredible. I had a lot of fun. One of the events during that year was actually in Bahrain, so that when the supercars were over there. So I commentated there, and the Bahrainis came in, the organizer, and they said, look, we love your work. We're going to call you back for Formula One here. And I said, oh, fantastic. That'd be awesome. I really appreciate it. Thinking, yeah, I'm never going to hear from these guys again, right? And at the end of that year, disappointingly, Supercars did not renew my contract and basically put someone else in, and just no explanation, nothing, just flung it. And I thought, okay, well, there's a sign here. It means I'm not meant to do stuff here. I'm meant to do Formula One stuff overseas, the stuff I really want to do. And before I could even chase it, Bahrain was on the phone wanting me to do their World Endurance Championship event, then their Grand Prix. I worked at Singapore. I worked at Spain, Italy. I worked in America. My last event that I commentated there was in 2023, the Vegas Grand Prix, the return of the Vegas Grand Prix. So. So through all these years, I've maintained like doing 5 or 6 major international events a year, and I love it. That's more than enough for me. And I was approached by the XCAT World Championship, which is a powerboat racing series worldwide, and I did a number of years with them doing their World Feed TV commentary, which was amazing. It was like Formula One on water. And so there's been some amazing opportunities, but it's interesting. It was from getting flung from the supercar gig in 2008 and feeling all terrible and being told I wasn't good enough and all that sort of thing, to getting all this fantastic international work that, funnily enough, I don't see any of them doing. So I'm very happy about that. I have a little giggle.
Isn't it so true in life, you know, that journey might end and you don't know why and you can't see the reason why, but you've just got to trust that there's something else that you're meant to be doing. And wow, what a journey that continues to be.
And it continues to this day. You know, COVID put a big dent in it, that's for sure. And I had to sort of work it back up again, and I'm nowhere near the number of events I used to work at now, but there's still quite a few, and I've made some wonderful contacts overseas and feel very privileged when they call someone from Melbourne, Australia to come over when they've got stacks of people much closer to them that they could use, and very, very flattering indeed. But yeah, the other thing that was really satisfying about all that was the Northern Territory government getting in touch with me and saying, we want you to anchor our supercar event. I said, oh, I don't think supercars would be too happy with that. And they were like, well, we don't care what they think. And so I did 5 years, and there I was as the host commentator working for the event, and there was nothing they could do about it. And I just laughed. I just giggled. I thought it was hilarious. In relation to the conferences, conventions, and all that stuff, that's, again, a flow on from my aftermarket PR work. And I've been lucky enough to MC some major conferences around the world. And the best one was in Spain in 2018 for the Capricorn Group, one of my clients. And that was extraordinary. It was an amazing event over 7 days. And you don't get too many gigs like that in your lifetime. And I've done lots of other media events and stuff. And I really enjoy that part of it too, because you're always learning something when you're working on events like that.
Now, 30 years down the track, we've just, as we've heard, you're still developing motorsport marketing strategies for a whole host of global and national automotive aftermarket companies. You're still considered a successful PR and marketing services company in a very specialized industry. Again, going back, did you ever think as a self-employed consultant that you would reach this 3-decade milestone and all the successes in between?
The interesting thing about all that, Kylie, is that I just didn't think about it. I just kept working. And it was only when I hit the 25-year milestone, and that was during COVID, I thought, my goodness, I've been doing this for a while. It wasn't something that I was thinking about how long it was going. I just kept working, just kept going. When it got to that point of 25 years, I thought, no, this is something I've got to start making some noise about all this, because there aren't too many small businesses that, let alone survive, but grow and thrive through 3 decades. And the longevity of it all has been amazing. It's gone so quickly. That's all I can say. I can still remember going into my office in Lygon Street in East Brunswick and thinking, what have I done? You know, I lived off a credit card for the first 12 months. I had no money. I was like, what have I done here? You know, I've thrown everything away. And no, it by persisting and bit by bit, it all came. And did I think I'd work with the companies and the people I've worked with? Absolutely not. Incredible. I mean, to say I've done photo shoots with Richard Branson, you know, I mean, that's just incredible. Like, things I could never have ever envisaged happening as part of my PR thing. But through automotive and motorsport is how these things happened. And even like I'm very keen with aviation, for example. I love aviation. If I wasn't doing automotive PR, I'd probably try to do aviation-based PR. And even through motorsport, I got to work with Qatar Airways, Etihad Airways, you know, on the various Grand Prix that they've sponsored and things they've done. So everything I've had a passion for in some respect has been given to me through motorsport. So in terms of longevity, when you're enjoying what you're doing, you just don't notice the time going by. It's just as you see your age, you're getting a bit older and stuff. But for me, it's a wonderful milestone. I never thought I'd be doing it for 30 years when I started. I had no idea where it would go, to be quite honest with you.
And again, it goes back to that bravery. Often it's that initial first step, I find. And I think, is it a case with you that you've said yes when opportunities have come your way? You mightn't have known how I'm going to do it, how I'll figure it out, and I don't know where it's going to lead. It's not something I've thought of. But is that part of your mindset?
Oh, absolutely. And the younger you are, the more fearless you are. And I've noticed that in my early years, yeah, yes to everything. Yes, doesn't matter if I can't. I'll work it out. I'll talk to the right people. I'll find the way and I'll get it done. And you're just fearless. What I found is as I got older, you're sort of more cautious about things that when you're younger, you just jump in and do. But having said that, yeah, I've said yes to lots of things that I was very unsure about whether they'd work out, but they did. And that's just through committing yourself, working hard, seeking the right mentors, really important. I've had some amazing mentors throughout my career that I could rely on and speak to and get good advice and move forward from that. And also doing things my own way as well. So there'd be lots of times, oh, that's not the way we do it. Well, that's fine. This is the way I'm going to do it. And it worked. So saying yes to opportunities is very important. And sometimes saying no to other opportunities is important as well.
And that creative mindset, I imagine, in PR has been so crucial and a real craft. That where do some of your great ideas come from? Do you allow time for rest and recovery and ideas to flow? It sounds like you go, go, go. But where does it come from for you? Because you come up with some fabulous opportunities for your clients.
Well, there's a combination of things. Sometimes you're having a meeting and somebody says something in a brainstorming type situation, you think, wow, that's a great idea. I'm going to run with that. And a lot of the time you're thinking of it yourself. 3 o'clock in the morning, get up. Oh, that's a great idea. Write it down. But it's just being creative and just looking beyond the square, you know, trying to come up with ideas that are going to work, that are going to appeal to the press and to the public. And it's gotten harder over the years with the advent of social media and that, because everyone just puts everything up. And it doesn't matter if it's interesting or not. They're just throwing everything there and they're calling that PR, and it's not PR. Good relationships with journalists, coming up with ideas. Many times I've actually rang a journalist and said, or an editor, and said, is there anything you think that we could do that could help you with your coverage and stuff? And they've given me ideas, you know, and I've run with that. But there's been some beauties. Like even just 2 years ago with Dave Russell, smashed a PR coup with Gold 104
FM. This is a radio story. Yes. Mm. Now, for our audience, just explain this show and its popularity and what you were able to achieve and the goal. It was just classic.
Yeah, it was an incredible situation considering it was. I did it in Porsche Carrera Cup and not for the supercar team that one of my clients sponsor. Basically, we had horrible bushfires through Victoria a couple of years back, and a brewery set up a beer called Heroes Gold, and Gold 104 were promoting it. It's a huge show, Christian O'Connell, top rating breakfast show here in Melbourne, and they were looking for ways for getting this message out for Heroes Gold. And it was just before the Adelaide 500. So I rang the team owner of Dave's team, Roger Largo, lovely man, who's a philanthropist, by the way, and is always donating stuff to charity anonymously and stuff. And I said, look, Roger, I've got this opportunity. I'd like to help them and do something, and we'll get a stack of press out of it. And he's like, yep, no problem. Give them the roof, give them the front. So we get all this signage done. But anyway, I send the email off to I sent the email off to Christian O'Connell and just said, hey, you know, let's run the Heroes Gold and the Adelaide 500 and a top three car, and let's try and win it for you. Let's get some publicity for this fantastic cause. And he just, it just blew his mind what I'd offered him. And next thing you know, I'm on the radio the next day explaining how it's all going to happen, and we're having a big laugh about it. And they just kept running this interview and this discussion that we had every single day. It was crazy. It was everywhere. My phone didn't stop. And I thought, that's PR. You know, that's satisfying. That's when you've done something that really, really works. You've linked in with something that appeals to everybody. And in the end, I think we came fourth over the weekend there in Adelaide. So we got them a stack of TV coverage, and it was excellent. And then, of course, they kept replaying it. And they replayed the commentators talking about it in Adelaide. I sent them recordings of that, and they replayed that at the station over and over and over again. It was just extraordinary. This thing just didn't stop. Yeah, it was a classic case of how you can still get massive PR if you work hard at it and pick the right opportunities. And I had to think, it was an advertising agency guy called me and said, there's this thing, you should chase this up. So he was the one that first brought it to my attention. But again, if you have contacts, if you've worked hard and you have contacts all over the industry, that's what happens. They feed you opportunities, you know, and this was a really good one.
I love it. And I look forward to picking your brains a little further about what you think the future looks like for PR, because that was a cracking example. But before we get to that, you've talked about the Formula One Grand Prix and all that related work still forms part of your business. It hasn't waned over the years. That's still something that you're super passionate about. And we see the popularity of Formula One. I mean, my goodness, Drive to Survive and all the rest of it. It's an amazing era. And I'd imagine that it only grows, your association with F1.
I still get the same buzz every time I go to a Grand Prix, whether it's in Australia or wherever it might be in the world. I get the same buzz when I walk through the gates, you know. So it's just amazing. I love it. I've always loved Formula One from when I was a kid. My dad and mum introduced me to it, and I've loved it ever since. My first Adelaide events were going as a kid with my parents, right? And then that extended right through. So I've always loved it, always got a buzz out of it, and I still feel the same about it now. In fact, I'm really happy that Drive to Survive has happened, because it's proven the potential of how big Formula One can really be. Like, we always thought it was big, and it was big. It was huge. But this has just hit the stratosphere, and it's still growing. It's still incredible. The Formula One launch they did just the other night, I mean, that was just extraordinary. And you just think, thank goodness for Liberty Media. Thank goodness that the Americans got involved, because they know how to put on a show. They know how to get people interested. And of course, Drive to Survive is just a stroke of genius. That was just incredible. It's made so many people, particularly younger people and females, get into the sport and realize what it's about. Do I still feel passionate about it? Yeah, probably more than ever. Formula One's the ultimate.
In terms of the future of your company specifically, but also the PR industry in general, we touched on it a little earlier, given the changes that have taken place, particularly over the media landscape over these 30 years. Can you just talk us through yourself, your company, and PR more generally, and what you're seeing out there and what the future looks like?
It's very interesting at the moment. There's a lot of change out there. And, you know, I've been told by several people, oh, you're in a dying industry. There won't be any need for PRs because of ChatGPT and AI and all the rest of it. And I argue the point. Yes, things have declined because there are less media outlets to deal with. That's a reality. There are less journalists out there. But there's also a plus to that, and that is that the media companies don't have the journalistic resources to cover stuff. So they rely on good quality PR more than they ever did before. So that's one side of it. So I'm seeing that. I'm seeing that there are difficulties because you have less publications, you have a lot of websites and all that sort of stuff, and you service them as much as you can. But, you know, things are challenging because you've got companies out there saying, oh, we don't need to do this anymore, we just do social media. And it's not until their sales go through the floor that they realize the mistake that they've made, because you can't place everything, all of your marketing, into social media. And you certainly can't do a motorsport sponsorship without leveraging it properly PR-wise to reach your customers. You can do it as a branding exercise, but to get out to them, you need to PR, and you need to PR and leverage it effectively. If you're not, you're just wasting your money. And we see this all the time. So I've still got some great work coming in. I've still got some fantastic international and local clients. It's not as busy as it used to be. That's 100% true. But the stuff we do is these days is very, very high quality and more on a global basis than just concentrating on the market here. And to the people that think that ChatGPT and AI are going to take over, well, show me how AI calls an editor who he's known for 30 years or longer and pitches the story and says, like, really appreciate it if you could run this as a cover story as a thing. And the editor says, yep, no worries, all right? The strength of your long-term relationship. Computer programs do not have relationships with journalists or media or people that they've known since they were cadets and have helped them and treated them with respect for all those years. And that's why when you pick up the phone, things happen. Right? It's all about relationships, just like any other business. So while people think it's all going to be automated and stuff, that can work to a certain point. The other thing I'm always reminding people about when they want to use ChatGPT and AI for their sole PR purposes, we don't need someone to write this, it can all be automated. That's fine. But all that content is plagiarized. It's all copied from somewhere else and put together for you. And it's very clever how it's done, but that material belongs to other people. And if you're unlucky, you may get into trouble for doing that. But hey, if that's what they want to do and if that's what they think replaces PR, well, good luck to them. As a future for me and my company, I'm just going to keep doing what I do, following my heart. I think doing what I want to do more than what I have to do is a key mantra from this milestone moving forward. And I'll just keep doing it for as long as I enjoy doing it. You know, I have no intention of stopping anytime soon. As long as I can still chase racing cars around and do some good corporate PR work, I'm happy.
I love that. Whatever it takes to get your passions happening. And look, just a question without notice, you know, you touched on your mentors and you perhaps are a mentor for others yourselves. Is there a mindset or philosophy or advice or wisdom that you reflect on or that you like to share or anything of that that you'd like to pass on?
Yeah, well, work hard. Work very, very, very hard. You'll find that 98% of everyone in the industry won't work as hard as that. So the harder you work, the more successful you're going to be. I also tell them that, particularly if they're in motorsport, there are no birthdays, there are no Christmases, there are no Easters, there are no holidays, right? When you start out, okay? Because, and particularly when you're single, when you've got a family, it all changes 100%. But when you're establishing yourself, don't complain about days in lieu when you've got to work on weekends. The things I've seen from younger people these days and the comments they've made, oh, I had to work, or they wouldn't take a job with the race team because they had to work on weekends. Well, when do you think they race? It's extraordinary the amount of laziness that not only now, but this has happened in the past too. I just find that the biggest enemy to people getting into the business of PR or in motorsport, in general, the business of motorsport, is laziness, is not willing to put the hours in that you need to do. And when it's your own business, every extra hour you work is more money in your pocket. I've never had a number of staff. I've had some consultants help me from time to time. That's not been by choice either. I did try employing some very good people, but they were too good and they got snapped up either by my clients or by other companies. When it was a big step up, I never stood in the way. I just said, congratulations, off you go. I also had clients saying to me that they'd rather deal with me than other people. That was a bit of an issue. So I ended up deciding about, you know, halfway in that I'm going to be small and boutique rather than large with a whole heap of staff and so forth. So that wasn't by choice. That's just the way it happened. But I'm glad it happened that way. It just made me work very hard.
I love it. Any last thoughts before we wrap up? I mean, 30 years, it's hard to condense in a short period of time. But, yeah, any other words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that, you know, if you're thinking of getting out there and setting up your own business in whatever it is you're doing, whether it's the automotive aftermarket or motorsport or whatever industry, go and do it. Do it. Don't wait for someone to give you the opportunity. Kick the door down and do it yourself. That's what I did. And I remember people saying to me, oh, if you think you're so good, why don't you do it yourself? And I've never forgotten that because that was one of the key things that made me do it. And then I'd see people again and they'd be like, wow, you know, look what you've done, you know. And make it happen yourself. Don't wait for the opportunity. Particularly I hear people, oh, gee, I'd love to work in Formula One. I'd love to do it. Make it happen. Now, you're not going to get a job with an F1 team straight away. Of course you're not. But go over to Europe. Go to some events. Make some contacts. You may land a job with a small team, with a Formula 3 team or something. But these are the things you've got to do. But you start off here. You know, start off small. But you've got to get out there and try and make it happen for yourself. Don't wait for a job to be advertised. Don't wait for somebody to tell you that there's some opportunity. Just try and make it happen. And you'll be surprised that when you immerse yourself around the industry you want to be in by forking out money yourself, like I did. I got to tell you, I spent every dollar I made in my DJing and radio career. I did club DJing for many years on going to F1 and IndyCar events and other events all around the world. Every cent I made, I spent on that. But you know what? It was very, very well spent, because there are contacts to this day that I use and have from those visits back in the mid-90s to late 90s and into the 2000s. And you've got to immerse yourself in it whichever way you can, and you will succeed. You will get somewhere. And you've got to work very, very hard, like I've said. Nothing comes easy. And if it does come easy, it won't last long. So work hard, kick the door down, make it happen yourself, and have fun, most of all. Make sure there's a bit of passion in it, because it makes it so much more enjoyable.
Oh, what great words of wisdom. And did I pick up your club DJing days? My goodness, we haven't touched on that.
Before the radio days, well, during the radio days too, I was a club DJ from the mid-80s through to, I think my last DJing gig was in 2009 in a nightclub in Melbourne. I worked virtually all the clubs in Melbourne. I loved it. It was just great. And I had a radio show that was a dance music radio show called Dance Till Dawn on a station called Triple RFM in Melbourne. And that then put me into doing commercial radio from there. But yeah, I loved the club DJing days. They were great. They were a lot of fun. And back in the 80s, people loved nightclubs. So it was huge. And yeah, had a lot of fun. But we weren't the cultural icons that DJs are today. You know, when I think, you know, there are DJs out there making millions of dollars by making albums of other people's music.
It astounds me.
And you know, when I did a DJing gig, we'd start at like 9 p.m. and finish at 7 in the morning at some clubs. They were licensed that late. Now you've got 15 DJs turning up doing like a half an hour each or whatever. It's just, it's so weird how it's all changed. But look, some of it's really good and some of it's really crap. But yeah, I never thought the DJs would become the cultural icons and the millionaires that they've become simply for playing other people's stuff. Lucky them.
Oh, what a fun reflection to finish off. And Paul, sincerely, congratulations. I mean, 30 years, the anniversary of Marinelli PR, it really is a great example of what can be achieved when we take that initial leap of faith, as you did, and continue to display the passion, the purpose and the creativity, which you still haven't lost, to deliver great results. So it's been such an honour to reflect on your journey and perhaps inspiring the next generation. So shall we reconvene for the next milestone?
I hope so. 50th will be a bit old by then, but we can do that. But you've been around since the start. I remember you from the very earliest days, and you've worked so hard on your career as well and achieved a lot, and you understand it. You get it. You know. So when I was thinking, like, who would I like to talk to about all this and to record a podcast with, you were the first name that popped into my mind. So thank you so much, and thank you for your contribution to career as well. You've been very, very helpful with stuff over the years as well.
Oh, thanks so much for the kind words. It's all about the storytelling, and yours is an amazing story to share. So thank you for that opportunity. And for those listening, thanks for joining us.